Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for High Velocity Radio.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. Stone Payton, Lee Cantor here with you this afternoon. Lee, this is going to be a fantastic segment. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast author and vice president with The Great Game of Business, Mr. Steve Baker. Good afternoon, sir.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, fellas.
Well, Steve, before we get too far into things, I'm familiar with the book Great Game of Business. That was a while ago, but can you tell us about the business of The Great Game of Business? How are you serving folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So The Great Game of Business book, that was Jack Stack's first book back in 1992, told the story of SRC Holdings, which is the Springfield Remanufacturing Corporation, which we are still here. That story started in 83, book came out in 92. About that same time, people would call up Jack, the CEO of this remanufacturing company, and say, hey, I want to come have lunch. Pretty soon it was more and more people. Then they wanted tours. Jack said, I can't run the company and have all this going on. Let's start another company. We'll call it The Great Game of Business because people wanted to see this operating system, right? This business operating system that Jack had invented called The Great Game of Business. And as soon as he started charging for it, more people came. So since 92, we've been helping people by having workshops, training. We do coaching, basically helping people understand how to implement open book management and really get both the financial results they want and the cultural change that they desire.
Now, as I recall, it's been a while since I read the book, but it started kind of out of a desperate situation. Is that accurate?
Man, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Jack, so his deal was he worked for International Harvester in the late 70s, and by the time the 80s rolled around, International was laying off 1,000 people a week, and this went on for 2 years. So he finally was sent down to Springfield, Missouri from Chicago. And he was sent to close the factory, 119 little people there turning wrenches, remanning these diesel engines for International. And when he got down here, he realized people had this work ethic of like, give me the tools, get the hell out of my way. He said, we got a business here. But when he went to get financing, International wanted $9 million for the factory. And he could only scrape together $100,000 between 12 managers, right? Imagine that, going to a bank and saying, we're awesome. We're the best in the world at remanufacturing. Look at our certificates of awesomeness and excellence and on-time delivery and warranty. You know, he's like, I'm here to save 119 jobs. And the bank's like going, we're here to collect interest and this is a terrible loan. So he was desperate. 54 banks turned him down, Lee. I mean, this is crazy because it was a terrible loan, 89-1 debt to equity. But he finally learned the language of business by trial and error. Every time he went somewhere, he learned something new. You know, where's your cash flow statement? Where's your financial ratios? What's your business plan? And when he learned their language, he realized one important thing. If you've got a terrible loan, you got to find a terrible bank. And that's exactly what he did. He found a bank in Chicago that was in real trouble. They were making riskier loans so they could charge higher interest rates. And back then, it was really high. So February 1st, 1983, he booked the worst corporate buyout in American history, 89-1 at the deal rate of 18%.
Wow. And then what was the thinking of, you know what, everybody's got to know all the numbers. This is something that I just don't want to kind of have this burden on my own. I want everybody to understand that it's not one of these situations where, because we see this a lot of times where the worker thinks the CEO is some rich guy and the worker is working for this guy. And what made Jack say, you know what, I want everybody to see the numbers and see what's what here?
Well, first of all, that's a great question, Lee, because a lot of people miss that. In his journey, his odyssey to get financing, he learned that we were looking at the wrong scorecard, right? The banks are looking at the financials. We're looking at the metrics of a factory line. We've got to get everybody to understand this universal language. The thing is, when he got the loan and saved the jobs, guess what everybody said in the factory? Give me the tools and get the hell out of my way. So Jack's like, no. We were doing that. We were the best in the world before, and we almost lost it all. So let's make sure everybody understands the true measures of success. So we got to produce great results here. We've got to absolutely nail the technical part of this, but we have to understand business. And so he has a phrase he's used for many years, and I love it. It's the company is the product. It's not the stuff we make. It's not the services we provide, but building a great company gives employees everything they want: job security, career path, raises, bonuses, benefits, the whole shoot and match. So that's the big idea behind teaching people business is everybody's better off. The company's better off. The owners are better off. The employees are better off. It's a pretty neat system.
But in order to pull that off, you need to have a lot of trust. Add that component to the mix?
Well, in Jack's case, back in the 80s, you know, he didn't have a choice. I mean, it was like there wasn't any good news to share. It was all going to be bad if we didn't figure it out. But in the almost 40 years since then, what's really cool is we worked with every kind of company you can imagine, both for-profit, not-for-profit, government, education, healthcare. And what's really interesting is you are absolutely right. There has got to be some trust and there's got to be some courage on leadership's part. We always ask when we go in to coach a company, we ask the owners if there's a boat on the balance sheet, right? If somebody's hiding their personal expenses in their business, this is probably not going to work great for them. But man, I'm telling you what, the people who do, who actually say, yep, I'm going to open this up for good or for bad, I'm going to try to teach people the business and ask them to help, give them a little piece of the action, you know, in a self-funding bonus program, and let's see what happens. They typically outperform their peers, industry peers, by sometimes 6 times. It's incredible.
Now, when you have this kind of a setup, it sounds great when everything's going great and there's bonuses to be had and there's all this success to share. But when there's a downturn or something happens that's outside of the control, or maybe it was a mistake, and all of a sudden the numbers aren't great and things are bad, how does this come into play in that kind of environment where there's nothing to share, or the bonus you might have counted on from last year isn't going to happen? How do you have those difficult conversations?
Right, right. So first of all, the good thing is you're hitting on all the right points as far as what about bad news or what about really, really good news? We're way better. You know, will they want more? And the thing is when you play the great game of business, it's not a reverse looking methodology. We teach people business and we ask them to forecast their own numbers, which we then roll up because they're creating the numbers in the business anyway. And what's cool about that is you see things coming. And the beautiful part about that is it's not the boss's number anymore. It's our number. And we have a phrase around here we use a lot. It's easy to stop one guy, hard to stop 100. And so now that we're 2,000 people at SRC, it's really powerful to see when there's a recession coming, like the last one, you know, really, I would say most people didn't see it coming. We already had contingency plans in place. And now I'm not saying it was easy, but we had something in place. We had a plan B, and that's part of the system is to be thinking ahead and saying, how can we really get the results we need when we have to get them? And let's say we don't have a recession in the next couple of years, which we are sure that we will, probably after the election is our guess, but those contingency plans continue, right? So if in good times, what they become is our innovation engine. So when people understand more about the work that they do and their impact, instead of running for the hills, most people buckle down. They say, all right, what do I need to do? And they'll focus their energies differently. Some of our clients actually kind of, when they first implement, they find out that people who leave the company because they don't like transparency, they don't like to be in the know, so to speak, you know, that's okay. That's cultural Darwinism. We're looking for those folks who really want to grow as people, as business people, as well as in their technical area of expertise.
Now, do you think that this system kind of reveals the people who believe in personal accountability?
Man, I think so. I mean, I'll tell you, I wasn't here in 83. I joined 14 years ago. And this place and companies that practice the great game of business, you know, a culture of accountability is not for everyone. That is for sure. And I learned something about myself when I came here. I learned that I was very frustrated in business for many years. Look, I'm 56. I've been around, right? So coming to this place, I go, wait a minute. There's none of this, well, that guy's not pulling his weight, because we're all forecasting our numbers. And if somebody isn't pulling their weight, it's obvious. But instead of driving them out of the organization, we ask questions like, what do you need? What resources are we not giving you? How can we help? And that is so positive, because it gives people a chance to grow. And that's often the thing is, I think given the chance, most people will do the right thing. Just they, maybe they're not given the chance and the information.
Now, does this system work best for, you mentioned manufacturing, but can it work in professional services like an ad agency, creative endeavors, or is it best suited for people who make stuff?
Yeah, great question. That, because the book was written originally in 92 about a manufacturing plant, everybody kind of assumes, and you may remember that from reading it years ago, that it's probably works with widgets, you know, but in fact, we are no longer a huge manufacturing nation. And so about 80% of the people that we work with, you know, helping them to implement, are service-oriented organizations. In fact, you mentioned agencies and that sort of thing. A lot of folks are doing that. Software developers, we've got agencies, restaurants, just you name it, we probably got them. The thing and is, then- business is business, right? I mean, this universal language, Lee, I don't mean to rant, but I get pretty excited about it because it changed my life, right? I mean, I went from financially ignorant to, holy crap, this is it? And it's been around since 1494. You know, the financial statements aren't new. How come no one taught me before? I just had to get to a place where they trusted me enough to do something with it.
And then, so walk me through what an implementation of the Great Game of Business looks like in an organization. Is there a way to kind of just dip your toe in the water, or do you kind of have to go all in?
No, you can. A lot of people start out with just doing like a 90-day program to see if they can move a number. Just to see, if I teach people something about the work that they do and the impact they make, they'll often surprise ownership. So let me start in this fashion and say the reason that we call it the Great Game of Business, Jack had to come up with an analogy to teach people business that it's not that they couldn't understand it. It was that they didn't want to understand it, right? Great technicians, and I don't care if they turn a wrench or hold a scalpel or write lines of code, great technicians do not want to become accountants. And it's nothing against accountants, but that's what people believe. We're not trying to do that. We're trying to teach them how money works in a business. So like Dave Ramsey says, you know, Dave, the personal financial guru, he says, money flows from people who do not understand it to people who do. So we say, let's be the people who do. And so may I give you an example of how some companies do this if they're just trying to test it out?
Sure.
So imagine this. We'll say, do you even know how hard it is to make money in this business? And I'm just thinking about a grocery store that I worked with recently, a big grocery chain down in Texas. And this is how we train all their people, store to store, region to region. And people will go, oh, well, it's about, you know, the research says the average employee thinks 36 cents on the dollar. Well, in a grocery store, you make 2 cents. People will go, why do you get up in the morning? Because it's just so little. And so what we do is we say, well, just imagine 2 cents. What if we could make it 2.5? At our scale, what would the possibilities be to fund a self-funding bonus program, right? Now, I'm way oversimplifying it, but this is an easy way to get started. Then we'll take a dollar and we'll build an income statement. Just, you know, how do we bring in revenue? Well, we've got deli and we've got produce and we've got canned goods, right? I mean, you know, they'll help you fill it out because they're the experts in the grocery store. And they'll say, well, what are the costs associated with it? We'll have to pull some numbers and get some paperwork together and involve some people from purchasing and accounting and merchandising, right? But see how people are talking now? And we build it out. We say, well, this is revenue minus COGS is margin. What are our expenses? And then we reveal for the first time how much it costs to light this place and heat this place and cool this place, right? And all of your salaries and everything. We, by the way, we don't share salary information other than a consolidated number. And then at the bottom line, a net profit is a very simple thing to teach. I say simple because we take our margin minus our expenses equals our profit, and then we say in this grocery store, we bring a dollar in revenue, we get 2 cents on the bottom line. how many dollars do we have to sell to get a dollar on the bottom line? So they'll noodle it through, and at 2 cent profitability, you have to sell 50 bucks to get a dollar of profit on the bottom line. So if your bonus plan is based on profit, I'm just saying that as an example, you can do a number of different things for whatever your critical number is for the business. Now, everybody who owns a COGS line or an expense line, my favorite story about this, by the way, is after this training, the grocery store also said, you need to know some other things about this. Examples would be, what does a slip and fall cost in our store? So let's have clean floors and dry floors, and let's make sure we're helping everybody. And hey, this is what it costs when avocados go bad, right? This is business literacy along with the financial literacy. What's really cool is after a while, we were going store to store, region to region, city to city, and it was just so cool. We heard a story. We started carrying bringing this kid and other folks from the original store in San Antonio. We'd say, hey, tell that story. And this kid would say, you know what? I had my regional manager and my produce manager talking to me, and I had to interrupt them. I leaned over, picked up a grape off the floor. And they said, great job, hospitality, way to go, clean store. He goes, no, that isn't exactly why I did it. I said, what do you mean? Now imagine this frontline produce kid telling his regional manager he's got something to say. He goes, no, this represents, it could have been a slip and fall. And I know that in our store, the average slip and fall settlement is $5,000. So at 2 cent profitability, we'd have to sell $250,000 of groceries to offset this one grape. Boom, jaws hit the floor. Wow. So now we take him around, man, and he tells his story, and more and more of these kids. Isn't that awesome? That's the power of the great game. It's the power of giving people knowledge before you can yell at somebody to pick up a grape, but who cares? But when people think and act and feel like the owners do, man, they make totally great decisions. And the best part is it's an untapped idea farm. It's just untapped completely. And as leaders, our roles change because now we have to guide people and coach people because they have so many ideas, they may not know what to do first. And so what we have to do is say, let's stay focused on our big critical number. Let's go this direction because that's where the strategy leads. But it's not saying no, it's saying not yet. So we can keep that idea factory working.
Now, how do you help the company land on the appropriate number to pay attention to for that organization?
Well, we actually have a process, as you can imagine, where we gather data from, first we look at the world economy, then the U.S. economy, assuming they're in the States. Then we'll go into their industry, then their marketplace, and then right down to their business level, if you will. In the case of the grocery store, it's literally comparing them to who they compete with. Amazon, Walmart, right? The big guys, and saying, well, how do they compare? And how are they beating us in some area? Typically speaking, by the time you get through the external data that's available and the internal data, we do surveys with all the employees and say, what are the big issues on financial, marketplace, operational, and people issues? Something emerges. I mean, the data just yells at you. And so we call that a critical number, and it becomes the focus for a year. In the early days of SRC, you can imagine at 89-1, Jack knew there was one thing screaming at him. That was debt to equity. If we don't make the bank loan payment, the bank will take everything away from us. So it's the one thing that matters more than anything else. So in the example of SRC, if we didn't make the bank loan payment, quality didn't matter, warranty didn't matter, on-time delivery didn't matter. But in order to create a company that could pay the bank loan payment, to build a great company, wouldn't you have to have great quality, great service, great delivery? Sure.
Right. What if the critical number is I need more sales?
Yep. So what we do is we look at that. If it's a revenue number, then we're literally trying to touch every person in the company in an appropriate workplace fashion, of course. We're trying to touch people and say, how do you connect with that number? Now, the thing is, if it's a revenue problem, there's probably going to be a sales-heavy focus on this for the whole year. But I get down to the point of what are the drivers to that? Because if you just say more revenue, it's sell more. Do we have time for me to tell you another story?
Yeah, go ahead.
If you don't mind. So that was my life before, right? Before SRC. So I worked for 25 years for small family-owned manufacturing companies, not ever knowing anything below margin. And so every time, you know, when Joanne and I got married, we bought a house. I say, hey, how can I make more money? They said, sell more. Then we had a baby. How can I make more money? Sell more, right? Can you imagine this conversation? I got three kids. I had a lot of these conversations. And every time they said sell more, if you're in Springfield, Missouri, guess where you go? To Bentonville, Arkansas. That is not a great place. Yeah, baby. So the story ends like this. It's a brilliant story. That's for a longer interview someday, but I'm just saying, Lee, you are talking to the king of fragrant bath salts, baby. I was working for a bath and body company, and I was told to sell more. I went to Bentonville. It took me a year and a half, and we made the deal of a lifetime for me, and that was to sell Sam's Club 53 tractor trailer loads of beautiful fragrant bath salts. I was on cloud nine, never knew for years, even after I left the company, that the owner paid me a bonus out of debt. They had a lien on their house just to buy the materials for that order. So the thing is, if I would have known that we weren't making any money on it, I would have made a totally different deal with someone else we could make money with. And it's just so frustrating in retrospect, because I want to do the right thing. And I think people do try to make the right decisions, but sell more isn't the answer. So I would dig deeper. I'd say, if it's a revenue issue, what are the things we can do to drive it? Not for all time, but for this year, maybe even specifically for the next 90 days. My favorite memory of a company recently that had this issue, the sales force just could not, they could show us all kinds of data of all the number of contacts. They got their CRM out showing me everything about how good they were. In reality, I just asked them a question. How many customers have you talked to this week? And they'd say, 100. I'm just making that up, right? And I'd go, wow, that's a lot. Okay, so who did you talk to? And they would pull up their records and they'd show me who they talked to. And I said, so you talked to this person? Yeah, I did. Well, let me see your notes on that. Oh, yeah, here's in my email. Oh, you emailed them. Okay, gotcha. Did you talk to them on the phone? No. Did you talk to them in person? No. And what's really funny in this day and age, where we all get 150 emails a day, they had completely become order takers. And what we did is in that first 90 days, all we did is ask them to get in what we called FaceTime, right? Just show me number of hours of FaceTime. We set a goal together because people support what they help create. And they actually increased their sales 20% the first 90 days just because they did what no one else was doing in their industry, and that was showing up. So I'm not an expert on sales. I'm not. All we did is let them be expert. And when they realized I wasn't browbeating them, I was saying, what could be more effective than what we're doing now? And they went back to old school stuff. It was crazy. But they never would have got there on their own. I couldn't have guessed to get there. All I did was facilitate the conversation around the dollars.
Now, part of the great game, the business of the great game, is you have kind of consultants around the country that help companies implement this. Is that right?
We do. We have 32 coaches, and these folks are practitioners. So some of them are retired business owners. Some have sold their businesses, all having practiced the great game in life, and they're giving back. So it really separates us from the marketplace because our people are truly practitioners of the product themselves.
And then, so then in their local markets, how are they kind of getting in front of their sales prospects?
Well, it's really not so locally based, if you will. What we do is we look for the best personality fit. And so to get in front of them, you know, the coaches, oftentimes they'll speak at Vistage meetings or EO or YPO. We just put out a new book, and Jack just wrote a new book that came out January 1st. So we now have the original book that you mentioned, The Great Game of Business by Jack Stack. That was 92. So that's the what it is and where it came from. His new book is a dozen or so stories of how it's been applied and changing lives in, like I said, everything from for-profit, not-for-profit, government, healthcare, education, all these different sectors. And that's called Change the Game. And I love the subtitle, Saving the American Dream by Closing the Gap Between the Haves and the Have-Nots. It's really cool. So that's the why. So you've got the what and the why. And then Rich Armstrong and I wrote Get in the Game, how to create rapid financial results and lasting cultural change. This is the 10 steps, the how-to. And I'd like to share that, Lee, with your listeners for free as an audiobook, just for listening to your show, if that's okay.
Well, that's very generous. Thank you. How do they get it?
So just, it would be go to our website at greatgame.com/GIGMP3. So it's greatgame.com/GIGMP3. They can download the audiobook there free of charge. And there's a whole resource site with all the tools that we use in coaching. We just want to make sure that we live up to our big, hairy, audacious goal, which is to transform 10 million lives in the next 10 years.
Why do you think that more companies aren't doing this?
It's a great question about courage right there, man. It takes a certain value set. And what's interesting is I do a lot of speaking for Inc. magazine, like at the Inc. 5000 conference, and there's the, you know, the 1,000, you know, fastest growing companies in America, and you can almost separate a room and say, are we trying to enrich one person, or are we trying to enrich a lot of people? So there's only so many folks out there who are at the place, and I'm going to use this word carefully, but to have the business maturity to realize that if you leverage your people, you're going to get a lot farther, a lot faster. So when you talk about getting results as fast as possible, doing it alone is insanity. So what I look at is, are you ready to activate your people? Are you ready to believe that your people can learn this? And I'm going to tell you they can. So I think the big thing is the courage to take that step. And I am a convert, so I will tell you I am absolutely passionate about this because it has changed my life and changed so many lives that I've been, you know, a part of that process. Is that, believe me, take the step, try it out, even if it's like you say, dip your toe in the water, try it for 90 days on just one part of the business, one department or one work team, and just see how people behave. It might give you a glimpse of what could happen if you went further.
Now, do you think that it can work in today's world in terms of so many virtual companies where you have a lot of contract laborers doing different aspects of your job, but it's a small team is running the company, but they've kind of have a virtual workforce out there?
Yeah, it does actually work very well. You just have to decide as a leader how far you want to take it. We have folks who, there's a lot of virtual companies now, as you know. What's interesting is there's so much technology to connect that all we do is we're just leveraging the communication that's already happening and putting a financial component to it and then flipping the funnel, saying instead of us cascading numbers down to you, the front line, we're going to collect numbers in a forward-looking fashion, right, from you and then build them up. The interesting thing is if you've got contractors and there's just, if I understood your question, kind of a core group of leadership and maybe even ownership at the center of that, you can involve them in something as simple as 90-day mini games, or you could involve them in a gain share self-funding bonus program. It just depends upon your selection. My first idea on this, you know, personally would be try it with your core team first. Do it for a year. See how it goes. If you really like how it's going, you could go just one ring out. You know, maybe we go to the regional aspect then, or then we go out further. But the interesting thing is a diverse and dispersed workforce across the country, even internationally, even with embedded employees at other companies, are doing this right now. And all you need to do is contact us and we can put you in contact with them, because our community of open book practitioners are so giving. You don't have to believe me. Let us know. We'll hook you up with somebody who's doing it. And I love watching their weekly huddles when you've got, it's like a massive Brady Bunch computer screen because you got all these faces on there and people are talking about what's happening in their neck of the woods. And it's like church. It happens every week. We get in, we get out, 20, 30 minutes. We've built our financial forecast and we move on. We decide what we're going to work on in the coming week. And it's just incredible to see the accountability that can happen, even though you may be a continent apart.
Now, when you're implementing something like this, how much pre-work is necessary before it's ready to be kind of rolled out to all the people? And then once it's rolled out, when do you start seeing kind of results?
Yeah, I love it. You're asking all the right stuff, because this is what I would want to know if I were listening. Is that, so first of all, we'll take 2 to 3 weeks of pre-work as a coach. right? We're gathering data. We're asking questions. We're doing the survey work. We're getting the financial history, et cetera. And we're compiling and analyzing that. Then we'll show up for 2 days where we'll work with a design team. So that would be your core group that will be responsible for rolling out the great game. And we'll be talking about what is the critical number that's emerging here. What are the key drivers and what is it that we can do in the next 90 days to start driving it? Then we'll start to work with the entire group. So it doesn't matter if you've got 30 people or a couple of hundred, we'll actually pull everybody together. We may, in some instances, in very large organizations, the largest I've done this sort of thing with is about 800 at a time. That's a lot. But the point is we're saying, hey, here's our critical number. Here's how we got to it. Here's what you guys said. You know, basically saying we're on a journey. This is what you can expect in the next 90 days. And we want you to run a mini game on a driver. And we'll actually ask the frontline people who are in that meeting to help us drive that critical number in the next 90 days. Behind the scenes, we tell them we're going to be working on the first bonus plan, the first scorecard, huddling, forecasting, and then at the end of the 90 days, we come back together. We not only celebrate their mini game win and give them the rewards, we may even be paying out the first quarterly bonus. And then we roll out the huddle, right? So behind the scenes, we get good at forecasting, understanding what we're doing, how we can be better leaders in this open environment.
Good stuff, Steve. Thank you so much for sharing your story today. Once again, the website for Great Game, and also if they want to get their hands on the audiobook.
GreatGame.com/GIGMP3.
Well, thank you again for being part of the show today.
Yeah, thanks for letting me ramble. I'm very passionate about it, but really appreciate the time.
Well, we appreciate you. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on High Velocity Radio.